Thank you all for coming. What I'm going to say, it's lots of stories, okay? And they're all true, as far as I know. But I want to start off with two world-class football players. I know I've told this once before. I hope I haven't told it. It was at Arise I told it. Cristiano Ronaldo, I'm sure everybody's heard of that guy, and Lionel Messi. Arguably the most wealthy athletes that there are. $400 million they're supposed to be worth. So there's Ronaldo was being interviewed, and the response to one of the questions he gave was he felt that God had put him on earth to play football. So Lionel Messi at a later date was being interviewed, and this was put to him and was asked for his response. So he took a moment, just a moment to think, and he said, I really don't remember asking him. Get it? That he's God, that Lionel Messi is God. You don't get it. Oh. Does anybody else get it? Thank you. Thank you, Matt, for that encouragement. Okay. So I've called tonight What You Do Matters, Ruth, because we're going to be looking at Ruth. We're going to be looking at people's lives. I'm going to share about what happened to me and some stories that have happened to me. So What You Do Matters. And Rachel Dawson used that in July at an all-in service. And it really struck with me, and so much so that I came home and I wrote it down. So every day when I open my Bible, it's there. So that whatever I do, it matters. It really matters. God can use it. So earlier in the summer, I began thinking about Ruth, this amazing lady in the Bible. And so we put her on the Delta program, so I had the opportunity to do a couple of studies, and it was really good. So what about Ruth, this Gentile lady from Moab? And we read about her way back in the Old Testament. So where does she fit into God's plan? And I'm sure many of you know the answer to that, but this is the story. So the book of Ruth is found between the book of Judges and 1 Samuel, and it was set at the time of the Judges, and I'm sure you know some of the Judges, Samuel, Samson and Gideon and Deborah and so on. And twice in Judges we read the verse, Israel had no king yet, everyone did as they saw fit in their own eyes. And I think we could say that today, that's what life is like. We will see what Ruth did mattered, and it mattered hugely. So now I'm going to do some storytelling. Matt, you will be pleased about that. So I'm going to condense the story of Ruth. So a family leaves Israel. There should be PowerPoints coming up. The family leaves Israel during a time of famine and goes to Moab to find food. And that's a pagan land whose gods required human sacrifice. Now, Moab was the son born in an incestuous relationship to Lot and his daughter. And Lot, you will remember, was a nephew of Abraham. So Moab is located east of the Dead Sea. The parents are Elimelech and Naomi. Their two sons are Mahlon and Chilion. And the two sons marry Moabitesses, Ruth and Orpah. And after 10 years in Moab, the three men had died, leaving the mother-in-law and the two daughters, the mother-in-law and the two daughters-in-law alone. And they were in desperate straits. Naomi had heard there was food back in Bethlehem, because Bethlehem means house of bread, place of bread. And so she decided she would return. And Ruth was desperate to go back with her mother-in-law. And so she said, I'm going with you, and that should be the next PowerPoint. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. And those few verses seem to me that Naomi must have made a huge impression on Ruth with her faith in the God of Israel, our God. So much so that she was prepared to give up her own life of maybe going back to her family and then finding her another husband, or however it worked there. But she was prepared to look after Naomi and to travel back to Bethlehem. And that would have taken about 7 to 10 days, and I guess the journey would have been, could have been difficult, unsafe. And they arrived at the time, we're told, of the barley harvest. Now that's quite interesting that we're told it was the barley harvest. So we know that that would have been March or April time, and that was the Feast of First Fruits. It's interesting how these little bits are in there, but they're in there for a reason. And you have to sort of, when you're trying to tell a story, I need to go this way, but then I go off that way and think, oh, but no, I must come back and tell this story. But it's interesting, all these bits that are in there. So Naomi sends Ruth out to glean, and she finds herself in the fields of Boaz. He notices her and asks after her, and he realizes that this is the woman who was looking after her mother-in-law. And he gives instructions for her to be kept safe. So obviously it wasn't safe in Israel even then for a young woman to be on her own. But he sends her home with much grain, and he does care for her, gives her water and everything to drink. And here we learn about the law of gleaning, so that the poor and the destitute would be looked after. So the farmers were only allowed to cut their crops once, and they were to leave around the edges so that what was left could be picked up by the poor and the destitute. We also learn about the Levirate law of marriage, which is also about land and the kinsman redeemer, or Goel. And again, these are, once you begin to understand those sorts of things, you can begin to understand about the culture and why people did things, because some of these things that they're asked to do seem very strange and very odd, but they had a definite meaning. So, the Levirate law of marriage, the Old Testament law stated that if a man died, his brother had to marry the widow to protect her and to carry on the family name. And the law kept the widow from poverty and provided a way for the family name of the dead husband to continue. And we're not going to go there, but in Genesis 38, there's a very interesting story about Judah and his daughter-in-law Tamar, and how she decided this law was going to be kept. Genesis 38, if you want to have a look at that. It's hair curling, but there we go. Everything is in the Bible, I've discovered, everything. So back to Ruth. Naomi later instructed Ruth to go to the threshing floor at night, where she would find Boaz and lay at his feet and uncover them. The harvest needed protecting, so the men slept with the grain. What this meant was that Ruth was actually asking Boaz to be her kinsman redeemer. That's what it meant. But she had to let him know that he could not act without knowing that she was willing. What she had to do, she uncovered his feet, and he awoke startled. And he said, "Who are you?" "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." And he said, "The Lord bless you." Again, think about the hem of the garment. What does that mean? Apparently, it's very important. It was the emblem or rank or authority in Israel that was around the hem of the garment. You think about David and Saul. Again, you can go off at a tangent, so we'll keep on this line. But the hem of the garment, if you think about that, go home and have a look, find out what that means. Very interesting. So Ruth was asking Boaz to put the authority of his house over her. So she is invoking her right under the laws of Israel for him to take her as his wife. So very early the next morning, Boaz sends her home with even more grain, and we're told it's 6 measures of barley. Now, there must be a reason why it's mentioned 6 measures. But when she got home, Naomi knew that Boaz would sort this out. It obviously meant something. It must have signified something. But Boaz was not the closest kinsman redeemer. There was someone who was closer. So the next day, Boaz goes to, I guess, what we would call the town hall or the council, I don't know, where all the elders met and waited for the closest kinsman redeemer to come by. And it's put to the kinsman redeemer about marrying Ruth, and when he decides that it's about land and about it, it just was not going to profit him. So he said no. So he took off his sandal and he gives it to Boaz, and the transaction is signed and sealed, and Boaz and Ruth marry. So Boaz took Ruth. Now we should have the fourth PowerPoint. So Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout all Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So the genealogy. Boaz and Ruth become the parents of Obed, who was the father of Jesse, who was the father of King David. Now, one of the pillars in Solomon's temple is named after Boaz. Something else I discovered. I thought, great, interesting, really interesting, because Solomon, obviously, who built the temple, was David's son. I mentioned Judah earlier, and these are the descendants of Judah, which is the line of Jesus. I know we know all this stuff, but the line of the Messiah, our kinsman redeemer, who brought us back. What you do matters. Have you ever wondered what an amazing institution or fellowship the Church of Jesus Christ is? So over the past 2,000 years, countless organizations, governments, monarchies, empires have come and gone. But the Church, from generation to generation, century to century, millennium to millennium, has continued and grown. So we go from the Old Testament to the Apostle John. Just briefly, we thank the Apostle John for the Gospel of John, for the three letters of John and Revelation. And John taught Polycarp, and Polycarp taught Irenaeus, which took it into the second century. So there's what you do matters. There are links all the way through. Now we're going to look at Billy Graham, who died, I think it was 2 years ago. His story, how he came to faith. And I'm going to read it, and it is quite long, but I just want you to hear the links and some of the names you will be familiar with. As of 2008, Billy Graham's estimated lifetime audience, including radio and television broadcasts, topped 2.2 billion. That means that approximately 2.2 billion people have heard the gospel from Billy Graham's mouth. So he has shared the gospel with more people than anyone else in history. But do you know who shared the gospel with him? It actually is a series of events that has been traced over the years and starts out with one volunteer Sunday school teacher. You can count the apples on the tree, but who can count the apples in a seed, goes the old aphorism. And Jenny, I think you used that at Enfest, didn't you? So it is with the influence of a single person. So take Edward Kimball, for example. Never heard of him? Rest assured, most people never have. Kimball was a Sunday school teacher who not only prayed for the hyper boys in his class, but also sought to win each one to the Lord personally. He decided he would be intentional with every single last one of them. Surely, he thought, about throwing in the towel. If you have ever taught the Bible to young boys, you know that the experience can often be like herding cats. This is from America. One young man in particular didn't seem to understand what the gospel was about, so Kimball went to the shoe store where he was stocking shelves and confronted him in the stock room with the importance of a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. That young man was Dwight L. Moody. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with that name. He came here, I think, in the early 1900s when we had the one of the Welsh revivals, I think. So, in the stockroom on that Saturday, he believed the gospel and received Jesus Christ as his saviour. In his lifetime, Moody touched two continents for God, with thousands professing Christ through his ministry. But the story doesn't end there. Actually, that's where it begins. Under Moody, another man's heart was touched by God, Wilbur Chapman. Chapman became the evangelist who preached to thousands. One day, a professional ball player had a day off and attended one of Chapman's meetings, and thus Billy Sunday was converted. So what you do matters. Each of us can make a difference. Sunday quit baseball and became part of Chapman's team. Then Chapman accepted the pastorate of a large church, and Billy Sunday began his own evangelistic crusades. Another young man was converted, whose name was Mordecai Ham. He was a scholarly, dignified gentleman who wasn't above renting a hearse and parading it through the streets, advertising his meetings. When Ham came to Charlotte, North Carolina, a sandy-haired, lanky young man, then in high school, vowed that he wouldn't go to hear him preach. But Billy Frank, as he was called by his family, did eventually go. Ham announced that he knew for a fact that a house of real repute was located across the street from the local high school and that male students were skipping lunch to visit the house across the street. When students decided to go to interrupt the meetings of Mordecai Ham, Billy Frank decided to go and see what would happen. That night, Billy Frank went and was intrigued by what he heard. Returning another night, he responded to the invitation and was converted. Billy Frank eventually became known as Billy Graham, the evangelist who preached to more people than any other person who ever lived. And you could continue the trail and see where Graham and all of us started with the ministry of Jesus. Think about how far-reaching Christ's message has gone. This fascinating chain of events was triggered by a Sunday school teacher's concern for his boys. If you are like most people, you have served in some capacity and wondered at times if you were making a real difference or not. Maybe you thought about quitting because you didn't think you were making any difference. Next time you are tempted to give up, remember Edward Kimball, whose persistence and faithfulness was tremendously honoured by the Lord. The story would have looked very differently if Edward Kimball did not take his Saturday to seek out young Dwight L. Moody. The eighth PowerPoint is a quote by Ravi Zacharias. Jesus didn't come to make bad people good, but to make good people, to make dead people live. Jesus didn't come to make bad people good, but to make dead people live. This made me think about my story and my conversion. For me, it was dramatic. I felt as though on the 27th of September 1984, God changed my life forever. I remember coming into a building, one person, and leaving as another. I remember hearing the message so well and hearing about the cross. I don't think I'd heard that message before, even though I'd been going to a church, and what it meant, Jesus' sacrifice, what it meant to everyone. But it took an awful lot for me to get to that meeting on that Thursday morning, 35 years ago. I heard this lady talk about her life, and the invitation was given. And I remember thinking, if the person next to me goes to the front, I will go. And there I was, stood at the front. A new life had opened up for me, something so wonderful and so new and so amazing. And what a journey it's been and still is, but obviously still a work in progress. On that day, a small group of ladies young mums came round me and said, "Oh, we've got a Bible study. Do come, we'll pick you up." And so just to shut them up, I said I would, but I knew I wouldn't, because I just didn't, that's not what I just didn't do that. I didn't have the confidence to do that. So I didn't, said yes, but I knew I wouldn't be going. But the following Wednesday, I was ready to go, and that was it. I was off. And over the years, I've loved sharing Jesus with anyone I feel prompted to share it with. Early in my Christian walk, I remember one day being at home, and this thought or these words came into my mind, go and ask your dad if he knows Jesus. So I thought, okay, I'm going to do that. My dad was absolutely lovely. So I did, and I just said to him, "Dad, do you know Jesus?" And he said, "Yes, I do." And that was so special, so special. So it meant that our relationship deepened, even though it was really good. It deepened. It meant that we could talk about God, we could pray. It was just really special. It takes courage, doesn't it, to do something. But the blessing is so amazing. It just seems to open up so many things. Sadly, my mum had died before I knew Jesus, but I discovered later that the family used to come here to worship. So I know that she would have heard the gospel at some point and would have had the opportunity to respond. I know that she believed in God, but somehow people just didn't talk about faith. Just didn't talk about it. You just went to church but didn't talk about it. One day, some years later, my daughter phoned from college and said, "Mum, this is Richard. Please talk to him about Jesus." So, now, this guy was seriously into bodybuilding, and I think he was probably taking stuff he shouldn't. So what a challenge that was. It was amazing. But I was able to lead him to Christ on the phone. I don't know where he is now. I don't know. But he heard the message. He heard the gospel. So that was amazing. It was a privilege. I'm not a confident traveller. But a few years ago, God had a job for me to do. And I got off the coach at Heathrow, and I had to find the bus station for another 2.5 hour journey to make my way elsewhere. And there was one young man waiting on that bus station, so I asked him about the buses, and then he proceeded to tell me he was having surgery the next day and shared a bit about his life. And I said, "Oh, okay." So I offered to pray for him, and he was really happy about that, and so I was able to do that. There was a man in Frenchay Hospital when my husband Pete was there briefly. This man was probably in his early 40s, and he had his hands strapped up like this, and he was on intravenous drips, and his hands were covered, and he had a carer with him. And there was an opportunity when we were on our own. I don't know what had happened. Pete wasn't there. Something had happened. And so he was telling me his story. It was just horrible. He'd obviously taken too much medication, whether it was intentional or unintentional, I don't know. Had become unconscious and had obviously fallen over and had led on his hands for probably about 2 days and had stopped the blood flow, and there was possibility of his hands being amputated. So I offered to pray with him, and he was up for that. He was willing for that to happen. So I prayed for him, and I think I understand that they had decided at that time then not to amputate. But what happened to him after that, I don't know, because things happened with us that changed. We weren't there, and we lost track of what happened. But again, it was an opportunity to talk to someone about Jesus who was in desperate straits, as we were. A lady I'd worked with for many years, we decided to have a cup of coffee one Saturday morning, and was able to lead her to Christ on that Saturday morning. It was so exciting. I remember phoning Linda. It's when we had the Monday group. I said, "Oh, you won't believe it. She's done it. This year, it seems, I don't know what's happened this year, but I feel there's an openness with people. There's more of a willingness to hear about God. But I've had lots of opportunities this year that they're just natural. They just seem to happen. In March, I was walking somewhere and I was on my way home and I felt this voice say, "Go and visit these friends." And I'm thinking, "Oh, I want to go home. Go and visit these friends." Okay, I go. And I had the opportunity to pray with the carer who was looking after them. She had a bad back. And I prayed three times. It was quite specific. I prayed in English and then I felt, pray in tongues. So I did. And I said, "How are you?" And she said, "Oh, I just feel, keep praying, pray again." So I prayed in English, then I prayed in tongues. And then I prayed again, and she said, "I just feel, it's just," she was healed. On the Sunday morning, she came with a bunch of flowers to church and said, so I was thrilled. She was thrilled, obviously, to be out of pain. So that was amazing. But it was responding to a call that I really wanted to go home, but God was saying, do that. This year, in early April, I just knew I had to visit a lady in hospital. She was terminally ill. I took some UCB notes with me in my bag. I've always got some. I've always got a few bits and pieces in my bag. And it's a lady that she's... I won't go into detail, but she was really poorly. And I knew I would just have a window of time to be able to talk with her, because her daughter was due to be visiting. And I started the conversation with just, "Hello, how are you?" and just trying to get into it. And then she said, "I'm ready. I want to do it." I said, "Right, okay. So you want to know Jesus as your Saviour?" "Yes, I do. I want to do it." So I showed her the back of the UCB. There's three steps. And just because it had to be so brief, and we did it, and she just wanted to pray that prayer. She wanted to accept Jesus into her life. We just finished, and her daughter arrived. Now, her daughter was an atheist, so it was important that this was done. And 2 months later, that lady died. But she really wanted to ask Jesus into her life. And so that was so, so special and such a privilege. Shall I go on? At the end of April, I was invited to talk and share at a new group, and not here, in somewhere else. So I prepared, and I thought, right, I'm going to do this. It was sort of like an interactive Bible study. But when I arrived, I thought, oh, this isn't right. This is not going to work. What am I going to do? So I was, "Lord, please, you will just have to fill my mouth with your words. I just don't know what to do." But as the meeting started and I had to start, God just did it. It was amazing. I took along lots of UCBs. We had them at church, and everybody took one. I was able to ask them personally if they would like one, because I don't know where they stood, but I did do the prayer of salvation with them. So I was very grateful to have that opportunity. So and just after that, I was out gardening when my neighbour started chatting and saying her husband was asking her questions about death. What happens when you die? Why is there so much suffering in the world? So, of course, you know, that was great. Got into a lovely conversation, and it was really good. And her response was, "I need to be hearing these things." So it's another privilege to be able to just share those things. If I go on. There's a lady from Australia. It was after a funeral I'd been to. We were gone back to a pub. And we got chatting, and she was telling me how much she enjoyed her job. And I sort of had a little thought come into my mind. I thought, I said, "Oh, you know, this must be your gifting to be able to love this type of work, because I think only a few people could love that type of work and really get something out of it. And so I was trying to sort of encourage her in that and get more out of her. And then she went on to tell me that some things, anyway, it sort of led into me being able to give her a different type of booklet I had in my bag. And that booklet is now in Australia, but also her mother's now got one. My brother's now got one. It's sort of like, it's really interesting how that sort of, you know, it had to be somebody from Australia, but now my brother's got, it's brilliant, really brilliant. So I was really chuffed about that conversation. Got one more. Another lady in a shop that I've come to know is going through a very stressful time, and had again a window of opportunity to talk to her. She was really not in a good place, and I talked to her about Jesus, and she said, "You are the next person I'm supposed to see." When I was on holiday last week, I went into a church, and I just feel you're the right. So we talked about Jesus, and again, I was able to lead her to Christ, and that was this year. So what a privilege, and I think I'll stop there now. And could we have the YouTube clip, please, Ojan?